Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 5 years ago this week, same-sex marriage became legal in Pennsylvania as the result of a federal judge ruling the state's laws that prohibited same-sex unions were unconstitutional. It was a historic ruling for thousands of same-sex partners. So how's that ruling changed Pennsylvania, and what other barriers are gay couples looking to overcome? Our guest today, Amanda Arbor, is Executive Director of the LGBT Center of Central Pennsylvania. Ms. Arbor, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Jason Landau Goodman, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Youth Congress. Mr. Goodman, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. And you can go to WITF's Facebook page to leave a question or a comment. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. But before we talk about the impact the ruling had 5 years ago, let's go back to May 20th, 2014. Actually, this was about a month later when we had federal judge John Jones, who made this ruling in Pennsylvania, here on Smart Talk, talking about why he ruled the way he did.
Well, the challenge to the law, Scott, was essentially two-pronged under the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. And the executive summary is that we looked at it from a due process perspective and from an equal protection perspective. Again, those provisions applicable to the state through the 14th Amendment. And so they apply to, in this case, a state enactment, that is the sort of mini-DOMA that was passed by Pennsylvania back in the late 1990s. And ultimately utilizing existing precedent and also extrapolating from some precedent recently handed down by the Supreme Court of the United States, we determined that the law could not withstand constitutional scrutiny and therefore that it was unconstitutional.
Just some background there. DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act, as that was passed here in Pennsylvania and was nationally recognized as well, that the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, struck down. So take me back. There's a lot of legalese there talking about the legal reasons for the justifications for finding Pennsylvania's law unconstitutional. But take me back 5 years ago, Amanda, and your thoughts after that ruling.
Absolutely. So I remember that day and being in the office where I worked at that time and hearing folks talking about it and one person saying, you know, this means that I can marry my girlfriend now. And this was an exciting day for so many of us because it meant that finally same gender relationships were not relegated to a lesser status, that our identities and our love and our relationships had the same legal standing as heterosexual ones. And so there's a cultural significance to that. Being recognized and validated and normalized throughout a society that constantly seeks to other us. And there's also a practical significance, you know, having the access to legal, financial, healthcare decision, all of the types of things that a marriage partner has access to that had been denied to our communities for so long.
Jason, you're young. I don't know how old you were when that ruling was made, but your thoughts on it.
Sure. Amanda highlights several of the really key areas of protection that marriage provides in our country. And I was very young, and many of my peers, millennials, and now Generation Z, were not necessarily thinking about marriage as the forefront of the issue that mattered most to them. For many in the LGBT community who are not seeking relationship recognition right now, many of us are facing discrimination and violence, and that certainly depends on who you are and where you are. We have massive issues in our schools, in community violence, in all sorts of issues. And so from poverty and more, those are issues which may be more felt on a day-to-day basis for folks. And that's where we also have our priorities just as much as ever to address those key areas. Relationship recognition is great. And marriage equality is wonderful, and it certainly shifted landscape in the conversation on LGBT inclusion, but it is certainly not where it ends.
You know, that's interesting that you say that marriage wasn't like the priority, because overall, whether it's same sex, whether it's heterosexuals, whatever, people are marrying less today than they used to, and they're waiting longer to marry. But in this case, it wasn't something that a same-sex couple could do. So it was a barrier that was overcome. But as you said, Jason, not maybe the priority.
Right. And it certainly depends on, again, who you are and where you are. But that really matters, that basic inclusion institution of marriage. However, we were still before trans folks were at least first to be able to serve in the military, and now that is under siege. There are so many areas at the federal level that we were working our way up to as well that we are now on defense for in a lot of ways. So we still have to keep pushing for community inclusion and education so that we can continue to win these key policy areas going forward.
Amanda, the two of you have answered this question partially, but I'll ask it specifically. What impact did this ruling have in Pennsylvania? And we know that the ruling was made here in Pennsylvania, but then eventually the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a similar fashion that, the entire country now, it is legal for same-sex couples to marry. But what impact did it have?
I think it really helped to shift, as Jason said, the conversation and have an impact in terms of helping to normalize LGBTQ plus people in our broader society, as well as giving us access to those tangible benefits that are attached to marriage. I've heard a lot of older LGBT people talk about how they never thought this day would happen in their lifetime. And so that is a shift and a really important shift. But there are also many, many issues that are still impacting our LGBTQ plus communities, and particularly our transgender communities, that we have to pay attention to.
And we're going to talk about those issues, but I did want to cover the history here. The everyday parts of life, as you called them, the practical parts of marriage, that was a big deal, because we all heard stories about loving couples that had been together for years but not legally married, that maybe one went into the hospital for a procedure that there would be someone say, well, you're not married, you can't stay in the room. Or there were Social Security issues, there were estate issues, other medical issues. All those things went away with this ruling. So on a practical basis, yes, it was historic and a real big deal. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And it impacts the economic security of LGBTQ plus people also. Those very things that you are naming, access to Social Security, access to estates, what happens when your partner is in the hospital. And those have really tangible impacts on the economic well-being of LGBTQ plus people.
It was a historic decision. And really, as I said, a huge decision, a big change here in Pennsylvania at the time. So much so that I think that we're at a point where many, if not most people, don't even notice. Jason, do you agree with that?
At this point, yes. There's a generation that has now come about in the past 5 years into society, just knowing that LGBT people can get married, and it's just like any other marriage. As a young person getting into advocacy at the time, it wasn't necessarily of like, wow, I can't believe this was in our lifetime. It was like, oh yeah, this is happening. And it's we're going toward full inclusion for LGBT people as part of the natural diversity of human existence. And so that it was just a matter of when rather than not of a matter of if it would ever happen in our lifetime. So I think there's just a huge cultural moment we're at now where there's an expectation that LGBT people should and must be protected under the law and included in our society just like everyone else. And that's where we've been over the past 5 years is getting closer to that under the law.
As much change as there has been, we still hear stories, though, of businesses, for example, some businesses that will not recognize same-sex couples and refuse to do business with them. What has to happen there?
There needs to be legislative action. We need to have sexual orientation and gender identity protected under the state's Human Relations Commission law, which has been around since 1955. This is an issue that many folks across the state have been advocating for decades. Currently, there's legislation in the General Assembly to address this. That's something that my organization, along with partners all across the state, are working toward. But it's not just about, it is about doing the right thing to provide for these basic protections in housing, employment, and public accommodations. But it's much more than that. It is a moral issue about treating your neighbors with respect and treating others how you'd want to be treated. And it's also a business issue as well. We want the best talent to stay in Pennsylvania, to come to Pennsylvania. And so we just have to get all these parties together to realize that this is really important for the future of our state. It's important for the future of Pennsylvanians, many of those who are LGBT. There are over 500,000, we estimate, LGBT people in our state. And so don't they deserve equal treatment under the law, just like everyone else? So that's the legislation that needs to take place to have this secured under our laws. And from that, we can continue to have the work done towards education and inclusionary work to make sure that our society is just and fair toward all.
You said that it is a moral issue. Those businesses that refuse to work with the LGBT community and to serve same-sex couples also see it as a moral issue. In fact, they say they have freedom. They base their reasons for doing this, most of them anyway, I can't speak for all of them, but on their religious beliefs that homosexuality is a sin and that they refuse to, abide by, something that they see as a sin. So, and they have a constitutional right to a freedom of religion. I guess what I'm pointing out there is that that's where there is a little bit of a curmudgeon here. It's a little bit of a difference in a lot of, for example, with civil rights with African Americans during the 60s, that it's a little bit different than during that point. But again, I know many people would say, no, it's not. It's not that big of a difference. How do you see this?
At least speaking from my perspective and many of those that are in this work, we love religion. We love faith-based communities. Many of us are of faith, and many faiths affirm LGBT inclusion. We want to make sure that all folks are able to participate in society. And part of that is making sure that all people, all Americans and all Pennsylvanians have the ability to participate in public space. So we're not talking about issues within faith-based schools or places of worship or fraternal organizations, private institutions. We're talking about the ability to walk into a restaurant or a movie theater or apply for a job that's posted in the public newspaper or rent an apartment. LGBT people face discrimination all across the state. This is not a relic of history. I have people in my organization, in my community, who are kicked out of their apartment or their house or fired from their job. Yes, you can get married on a Friday, but as the saying goes, you can be fired on Monday in Pennsylvania. Yes, we are trying to work our way through the courts, but unless we have something clearly in statute, this will not change. The legislature must take action, and until we have this law, LGBTQ people in Pennsylvania are left legally vulnerable, and that is a moral issue. And so faith shouldn't be a barrier for existence into public life. It should be something that empowers people to get there. And further, folks have used religion in many ways, however they want to practice it. But certainly it has been used as a place to separate people too. I mean, in past issues towards inclusion, people thought that folks were put on different places of the world to stay separate, or that women were supposed to be subservient to men, and we've done away with those ideas. And whatever faith tradition has supported that in terms of our laws and inclusion. And so we want to say that we respect people's faith, but this is not about our personal approaches to our faith. This is about participation in public life in Pennsylvania and in the United States of America.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WYTF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Before we get back into our conversation, I wanted to mention a Smart Talk road trip coming up June 6th. Smart Talk travels to the Eisenhower National Historic Site in Gettysburg to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion during World War II. Join us for the Smart Talk road trip. Watch the broadcast of the show live. We'll talk about the Normandy landings, part of Operation Overlord, which was orchestrated by the future president. Then stick around to explore the historic site of President Dwight Eisenhower's home and farm. Register for this free event at WITF.org, supported by Roof Advisory Group. During this portion of the program, we're talking about the ruling that came 5 years ago here in Pennsylvania that legalized same-sex marriage in Pennsylvania, the impact it has had, and really even more important about some of the other barriers and some of the other challenges that the LGBTQ community is facing here in Pennsylvania. Our guest today, Jason Landau-Goodman, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Youth Congress, and Amanda Arbor, Executive Director of the LGBT Center of Central Pennsylvania. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Jason, you were quite descriptive in pointing out that discrimination still exists here legally in Pennsylvania, but I just wanted to clarify that when you're talking about legislation in the State House and in the State Senate, that Pennsylvania is a state that does not have anti-discrimination laws, that those based on gender identity or sexual preference, that it is entirely legal to, I hate to say entirely illegal to discriminate, but that's what it is, based on housing, based on jobs, that Pennsylvania does not have those protections in place, correct?
That is correct. The Pennsylvania Human Relations Act of 1955 protects along 11 protected classes. Sexual orientation and gender identity are still not one of them. We are the only state in the Northeast United States that does not have this in our state law.
Hmm. How many states across the country?
There are 20 states in Washington, D.C. that have updated their state's non-discrimination laws, and we want to make sure Pennsylvania is among them as soon as possible.
Mm. So, Amanda, what are some of the other challenges facing the LGBTQ community right now?
So one of the biggest issues that we are seeing is the violence against our communities, particularly impacting LGBTQ plus communities of color, and specifically transgender women of color. So the murders of transgender women of color, particularly black trans women, is at an epidemic proportion. So in 2019 so far, at least 5 black trans women have been murdered across the country. These are just the folks that we know about. And just this past weekend, 2 black trans women were murdered on Saturday and on Sunday.
Where?
Melisha Booker, age 23, was fatally shot in Dallas on Saturday. And Michelle Simone, also known as Tamika, age 40, was fatally shot in North Philadelphia on Sunday. And that's just this weekend. And so this is a huge issue that we have to talk about. We have to acknowledge that it's happening, even though it is not directly impacting each of us within our communities, because it's vital that we address the ways that black trans women are marginalized in so many different ways that is leading to this epidemic proportion of violence.
Why? Why do we know that, why is this violence occurring?
So if we think about any community, any group of people who are marginalized experience higher levels of violence, right? So we know this to be true for women. We know this to be true for people of color, specifically black people. We know this to be true for transgender and non-binary people. So when someone embodies identities at those intersections as a black trans woman, they're experiencing the compoundedness of those oppressions layered on top of each other, making them more vulnerable to experiences of violence. People target those who are more marginalized and who are more vulnerable and who have the least protections and resources available to them.
Now, are those women you mentioned, and I know that, you know, we're talking about a number of specific cases, but were they targeted specifically because they were trans?
In most cases, yes. And in some of the more recent cases, I think they are still finding out the details and trying to determine more of what happened. But it's always a piece of it, whether it was intentional bias or whether it was underlying bias. It's that transphobia and anti-blackness and misogyny is always part of that.
Well, the people who committed the crimes, have they been arrested? I mean, I guess what I'm looking at is there a consistency of who is committing the crimes? White males, black males, white women, black women. Is there any kind of consistency there?
I'm not sure of the details of that. I know the most recent case in Philadelphia, it is currently under investigation and they are seeking the killer. I don't know the details of all of the situations.
Go ahead, Jason.
Unfortunately, many individuals who perpetrate violence against LGBT people, particularly trans women and trans women of color, are not brought to justice. And there's many reasons for that. And that is unacceptable. And many police departments are working as hard as they can. And sometimes that is a concern that they may not be. Mm-hmm. And so we really want to press for catching those who cause violence against the LGBT community, just like anyone else in our society. But further, as going off of what Amanda was mentioning, a lot of these issues are very related and very intersectional. So when we're talking about disproportionate impacts because of bias and discrimination, that impacts people accessing healthcare, having doctors turn them away at the hospital because they don't want to treat people like that. And that happens in this year in Pennsylvania. You have issues where people can get jobs, so they're thrust into poverty, or they may be having housing instability, and yes, may be forced to partake in activities in the underground economy, further criminalizing LGBT folks because they can't get jobs or they can't keep a roof over their head. And so that needs to be addressed. There are so many issues in which LGBT people feel the acute nature of discrimination because we don't have these protections. So non-discrimination will help not just the direct cases of discrimination, but will help shift the landscape so that LGBT people are more included in society so that they can more easily get jobs. They can more easily find housing and have an educational opportunity just like everyone else. So just as marriage equality helped us further this conversation and further towards inclusion, non-discrimination is the key component to really help us and help everyone and lift up those who are feeling the most brunt of discrimination and violence.
Now, when you're talking about violence, there's discrimination as part of it, but you're also talking about a hate crime. What are the laws today in Pennsylvania as far as protections against the LGBT community?
So we have an interesting story on that in Pennsylvania. We actually were a state that passed an LGBT inclusive hate crimes law in 2002. Unfortunately, due to technicality, the Commonwealth Court struck that down in 2008. And so Pennsylvania's hate crime statute still does not include sexual orientation and gender identity. Several local communities, thinking really of Philadelphia, have worked to address this, and they have passed a local ordinance, but that can only do so much because of the powers they're granted. And so we really need to see the state take action, and every legislative session, legislation has been introduced to put this back into the state law, but it currently is not there. So we have a federal statute since then, the Matthew Shepard James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act that was signed into law in 2010, but that only empowers the federal government to investigate these claims. And so hate crimes is certainly an important component of it, but that's on the back end of incidents of violence. We need to have more preventative measures, such as LGBT inclusion in society, so that people know that it's not okay to target someone for who they are or who they love. And it's unfortunate that we need laws sometimes to uphold that, but that's where we are, and that's how our democracy is built in this country, is that we have laws to say this is the base level of protection. And so when we have our hate crimes laws, they should include LGBT people.
2008, I was aware of that technicality that the hate crime law had changed and that it hadn't been reenacted, if you want to put it that way. What reasons are given? I mean, the legislature, it's been 11 years now.
Mm-hmm. I think there's tending to be gridlock on lots of issues, and both here in Washington, and it's unacceptable. This is a nonpartisan issue. I think it's really important for folks to know that we're noted as one of the first states that passed an LGBT inclusion law in 2002, by a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and signed by a Republican governor. LGBT inclusion is not a partisan issue. It's about empathy and compassion towards your neighbors, your family, and that's all we're talking about, is being treated equally just as everyone else. People across the political spectrum got that before, they get it now. And it's unfortunate that some are still positing this issue as a political wedge issue. The conversations we're having in Harrisburg and all throughout the Commonwealth, I was just coming here from Northwestern PA this morning, are really positive about, you know, how is this not already illegal? There are many freshmen in the state legislature who are asking the question, how is this already not done? And so it's really a matter of leadership and courage for legislators to look at their districts and look at society right now and say, whoa, this is a really urgent issue to amend our laws from hate crimes to non-discrimination and move on so that we can work on really important issues.
You know, I get the sense, and just an observation, you tell me, but the question you just asked, Jason, of when the reaction that you get from people and even legislators is that a lot of people don't know that the discrimination law, the anti-discrimination law, does not include the LGBTQ community, or that that community is not covered under Pennsylvania's hate crime laws, that they just kind of assume that because it only makes sense, that there are a lot of people out there who just don't know. And I was curious to hear that when you say that even some freshman legislators don't know it.
Absolutely. And we're also operating in a state that has 55 non-discrimination ordinances at the local level. That's more than any other state in the country. So local communities in Pennsylvania, 55 of them all throughout the Commonwealth have been passing these local laws since 1982, Harrisburg in 1983. So and it's not just the cities. It's Camp Hill. It's Carlisle. Until the state takes action, many of our towns and communities are trying to do the same.
Okay, so the violence against the community is something you see as a priority. What other areas? I mean, I know anti-discrimination, it takes in a lot, but under that heading, what are the priorities right now? What's the next big barrier?
And I think, as Jason said, these issues are so interconnected, right? So the issues of violence are pivotal for us to address, but as are issues of access to housing and protection and employment and health care and all of these different things that impact our day-to-day lives. So being able to go to the doctor and get the treatment that you need, being able to go to work without facing harassment or fearing losing your job and your livelihood, you know, having access to stable and safe housing. All of these issues are critical and are interconnected, and we've been hearing from our communities here in central Pennsylvania that these are the issues we need to address.
When you say facing harassment, most employers, I would think, have a policy against harassing someone based on their gender identity or their sexual orientation or sexual preference. I mean, do employers, and I know this is a broad question, but do employers respect that? Do employers take that seriously? And if someone says, hey, I'm being harassed, that the employer will come down on the person doing the harassing?
I mean, it really varies. Again, since we do not have statewide non-discrimination protections, that does not have to be in policy for employers in Pennsylvania. And even if it is, whether or not that's followed through and really taken seriously will vary depending on the company. We know that 53% of LGBT people are not out at work. And so that says something in terms of how safe they feel and being able to share that.
Go ahead, Jason.
The business, yes, absolutely what Amanda has said, and also the business community has largely been leading on these issues. From our Fortune 500 companies in Pennsylvania to small businesses across the Commonwealth have included sexual orientation and gender identity as protected classes in their employment non-discrimination policy and their anti-harassment policies. That's really, really important. We are seeing, again, people at the local level from their business perspective wanting to attract and retain the best talent and having workforce readiness for all people and making sure LGBT people are included in that.
I want to thank the two of you for being with us today. 5 years since same-sex marriage became legal here in Pennsylvania. Amanda Arbor, Executive Director of the LGBT Center of Central PA, and Jason Landau Goodman, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Youth Congress. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Be sure to listen tomorrow for Smart Talk. We discuss foster care in Pennsylvania. You can also visit our website to get an outlook of conversations we're working on. Plus, you can also leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. The day before War of Will won the Preakness Stakes in Baltimore last Saturday, another racehorse died of a heart attack at the same track. A rash of horse deaths at Santa Anita in California earlier this year brought attention to racehorse health. Earlier this month, Penn Live reported that 87 racehorses died at Pennsylvania racetracks last year. So what's happening that is causing these deaths and injuries? Joining us today, Dr. Brian Langwa, president of the Pennsylvania Veterinary Medical Association and medical director of the Pet Pantry of Lancaster County. Dr. Langwa, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Also joining us, Dr. Kate Papp, who is a DVM veterinarian and co-founder of Pennsylvania Racehorse Rehoming. Dr. Papp, welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. That is the number to call. If you would like to leave a question on email, via email, go to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right. So the big question is, what's happening? Dr. Papp, what's going on? Why so many deaths?
I think that these deaths have been going on for quite some time. It's now just reaching more noticeability in the general public. Unfortunately, it's been known that death or catastrophic injury are very likely possibilities for ending for a racehorse. And unfortunately, most of them are linked to pre-existing injuries that are not being detected or addressed properly and are leading to catastrophic deaths that the public is now noticing. And as far as we're concerned, zero deaths are okay. So something's going to need to change here in the near future.
Now, as you said, and I wanted to point that out, is that it is not unusual. We are not seeing a rash of deaths. In fact, actually, there's been a decrease here in Pennsylvania in the number of racehorses that have died. But the Santa Anita case, because it was, I think, 23 horses that had to be put down over a three-month period, which was a high number during such a short period of time, that brought attention to it. Penn Live did this story on what happened here in Pennsylvania. Then there was that unfortunate case just Friday, the day before the Preakness at Pimlico. So it has brought much more attention to it. When you say pre-existing injuries, what kind of pre-existing injuries and conditions are we talking about?
Usually stress-type fractures, so they would be considered hairline fractures, I guess, for your human equivalency, where the bones or other certain soft tissue structures have fatigued, and if they are continued to be used in the same manner of speed and racing and training and are not given time to heal, those hairline fractures or those stress fractures or fatigue injuries will become massive catastrophic injuries, and that's what we see at the eventual end.
Dr. Langwell, give us a kind of a sense here, because let's face it, horses are different than human beings, even other mammals, in that a fracture, a broken leg, an ankle, that is enough that could cause the death of it, not itself causing the death, but maybe of the horse. An injured horse would have to be put down. Talk about the anatomy of a horse and what puts them in danger.
Yeah, one of the biggest issues I think that people don't understand is that you can't necessarily tell a horse, oh, you know, just lay down for 6 weeks or whatever, and allow
just
that to heal.
Just walk it off.
Yeah, type of thing. There are so many other things in not only the injured leg, but in the opposite legs. one of the biggest things we worry about is a condition called laminitis, which is an incredibly painful condition. The best way we describe it to the average person is basically it's a situation where the hoof actually starts tearing away from the bone that's in there. So it's almost like basically trying to walk on your toenail and having that toenail slowly pulled off your foot. It's a very uncomfortable and inhumane, basically, way for a horse to try to live. And with a lot of these injuries that we see, unfortunately, there is nothing that can be done. We've made incredible strides in being able to save a lot of these horses. I got involved in wanting to work in veterinary work and worked under a vet that actually worked on the Filly Ruffian when she broke down back in the 70s. And in talking to him, he was the surgeon that worked on her. He said, had that happened today, we could have saved her. So it just goes to show you what the advancements, but there are still things, unfortunately, the makeup of a horse, it just does not make it possible for them to survive some of these injuries. And it would be cruel to try to make them, endure those types of things.
So are most of these deaths as the result of the horses being put down, or do they, the case on Friday was a horse that actually had a heart attack. And I don't know whether that's been confirmed or not, because at first I know the jockey said, it was a heat stroke. The horse seemed very hot as it was going out into the starting gate. But are most of these deaths being caused by a natural death? Okay, maybe not natural, but a death that occurs to the horse, or are they being put down?
In most cases, it is a case of, in these catastrophic injuries, of us as veterinarians humanely euthanizing the horse. In the case that happened the day before the Preakness, we really won't know, and I think that's one thing the public really has to understand, is there still is a necropsy that needs to be done, there's still some tests that need to be done, so we don't know exactly what caused that horse to collapse. In most cases, it is a cardiac-type event that occurs, either a fatal arrhythmia or something like that. When the jockey did jump off the horse, what he immediately said to the veterinarian that had rushed right there was the horse was sound. It wasn't a case of an injury that happened to the horse. We do see heat stroke happen in some of these horses in hotter weather, and the vet that was actually on call treated it appropriately. She was trying to get the horse into a position to better recover from it, and it was then they noticed that the heart wasn't beating. And in those cases, it usually is a fatal arrhythmia that does strike the horse very, very quickly. So there's not a lot of suffering involved in those cases. But again, there's unfortunately nothing you can do.
Dr. Papp, you are in, I don't know if it's an unusual situation, but you're in a unique situation that your husband is a trainer at Penn National, and now you also work with some other horse owners as well. Does the horse racing industry care about the health? I mean, I know you can't make a blanket statement, but overall, do they care about the injuries, the health of these horses?
Caring and understanding seem to be slightly disconnected in the industry. And do they care? That's an interesting question. It depends on your description of care, because I see a lot of excellent daily care given to many of these horses. They are fed as well as any kings and queens could be. They are groomed. They're given ample opportunity for treats and attention and everything else. However, when care is costly, such as veterinary evaluations or recommendations that the horse no longer race or that they get some time off and your livelihood is risked based on that, the caring standpoint may take a back seat in many cases to the financial reality.
So in many cases, what you're saying is that the horse is a commodity.
Yes.
That money is what enters into the equation.
Yes, and I've actually heard many owners who have never actually met their horses that they own call them. This is a business. Let's run this as a business. You have to, they go in trying to make $1 million, and they always say the best way to make $1 million as a racehorse owner is to start with $2 million. So, and that is something I truly believe in. If you're getting into this industry as an owner, that to go in expecting to make money and not lose money is definitely not going to be the right industry for you, because you cannot predict what a live being is going to go through.
Something that horse racing has that is kind of unique to the sport is it offers claiming races, in that I remember years ago at Penn National that there were $2,000 claiming races. That basically how it works, for those who aren't aware, is that anyone could buy a racehorse. for $2,000 if it was a claiming race. Now, I don't think there are too many $2,000 claiming races anymore, but still, for under $10,000, you could buy a racehorse. What this does, it would seem, Dr. Langlois, is put pressure, put monetary pressure, put financial pressure on trainers, owners, to maybe run horses that shouldn't be running.
Yeah, and I think some of it also goes to, and they've made better strides in this. A lot of what happened in a lot of states when a lot of the casino operators were allowed to come in and be part of racetracks was, what they did was for these lower level claiming races, the purses were astronomical. So it wasn't even so much the wanting of an owner to get their horses claimed. It was, oh, I can run maybe a horse that is not 100% ready to run for a purse of $30,000 and, you know, still make a good chunk of change. And even if the horse isn't claimed, well, then I can do it again. This was actually one of the biggest problems they found up in New York when they were having a rash of injuries 4 or 5 years ago. And they instituted a lot of rules saying that the purse level could not be higher, more than double the cost of the claim. And that really has helped kind of reduce a lot of that. There are certainly instances where people will just try to turn a horse around quick and, you know, they're guaranteed basically that money. So whether the horse finishes first or last, just still guaranteed that claiming price. It is a concern, you know, and I think what a lot of us, and I'm, you know, a pure passionate fan of the sport, is it may take a little bit of a rethink of exactly the structure of races and the types of races that are offered to help a little bit with the welfare issue that's out there.
What about drugs? I mean, I have to admit that this is one of the first things that many people think of when they think about a horse breaking down or a horse not being in good health, is that they have been given drugs to make them perform better. I mean, I guess the horse equivalent of steroids in baseball or other professional sports. That now Lasix, for example. Okay, let's take Lasix out of the equation. I'll ask about that in just a moment. What it is and why it is given legally. But what about drugs? What are some of the drugs that are being put into these animals that are jeopardizing their health?
Well, basically, there are allowed substances that are allowed to be given within a certain period of time before the horse races, which are your NSAIDs, so your non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that are given systemically, usually through an injection, similar to what a person would get for ibuprofen or naproxen, Aleve, something like that. And then most of the horses, I'd say about 80%, are running with phenylbutazone, which is an NSAID that takes away inflammatory pain within 24 to 48 hours. They're receiving it before a race, and they're actually getting their veterinary exams early in the morning in the case of night racing. And that drug may still be on board when they're being evaluated for whether or not they're limping or sore, and it may be easily missed because there's still medications on board. And there's other medications that are used and allowed to be used, such as injections into the joint at so many days out, but they're still having an effect at the time of the race.
Is there cheating going on?
Yes.
Okay, in what way?
I believe there's performance-enhancing substances being given, some known, some unknown, some caught, some not caught, and it leads usually to an extremely dramatic change in a trainer's win percentage and a horse's form. So a horse that may be performing consistently over the past 2 to 3 years at a certain level will all of a sudden jump in points and in class within a month of getting a new trainer. So to me, unless that trainer has magic hands, and some of these cases are a situation where you're going from a less understanding trainer to one that's been in the business longer, so it does happen naturally, but most of those times when you have a dramatic change, it's due to some sort of performance-enhancing technique.
Why isn't it caught?
Well, we can't afford to test for everything that people can use, is one thing. It's very expensive. We can't afford to test every animal. We can't afford to monitor every animal. And a lot of the drugs that they do give that would be considered performance enhancing can only be detected in the bloodstream for a few days after they're given, while their effects will last for up to months. And I guess, finally, there's ones we don't know about, things that come from overseas, things that are being still developed in labs that people have access to that unless we as a testing facility have access to that medication ourselves, we can't develop a test for it. So we may hear rumors on the backside that so-and-so is using something, but unless we can get our hands on a sample of it from wherever, we can't develop a test to find it.
Dr. Langlois, you said a few minutes ago that you are a big fan of the support of the sport. What Dr. Papp just described, and I use the analogy with other professional sports played by human beings, what it does is it lets often the fans, the sport loses its credibility, and the fans can't trust the outcome. And when it seems as though there's a lot of cheating going on, it would have an impact on the sport of horse racing, correct?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, you actually mentioned a word there that I think is not utilized enough in the sport, and that's trust. People look at other jurisdictions around the world. The gold standard is basically considered Hong Kong in the way they do racing. And there's a lot of things in Hong Kong that are slightly different from the U.S. structure that make it work very well for them. But the big thing is trust. I mean, the way they have their system set up, the trainers are trusting that their competitors are not going to try to cheat. The jockeys are trusting, you know, because the penalties are very, very strong. And so they know that things are on the up and up, and that transfers over to the fan and the bettor. We don't have that level of trust in the U.S., and there's a lot of things that can change to potentially do it from a fan standpoint. And I'm on the board of directors for a group called Thoroughfan, which our goal is to try to get more fans in the sport, is basically to try to get a little bit better transparency in the sport, which we think will lead to better trust, as well as one thing we would like to see is when these people are caught, there should be harsher penalties and there should be bans. I mean, you know, for some of these doping agents that are found, if you are found doing this, you're gone, as far as I'm concerned and a lot of fans concerned. There should not be second chances. And if you really get harsh with the penalties, I think you'll see a lot of that trust come back because people will realize that, hey, they're not messing around anymore. And there's no, like, you know, kind of, oh, just a slap on the wrist, don't do it again type of thing. The penalties have to be much harsher.
Well, one of the problems, I understand, is that there's no one organization that oversees horse racing. And that's an issue.
It is. It's a great issue, and it's one that it is not easily solved. You have a lot of different major racing jurisdictions out there. I think there's about 33 in the U.S. right now, 32 or 33, and they would all have to come together and agree to basically have it under one umbrella. And right now, the way the camps are set up, the interest is not there. There are smaller groups like the Mid-Atlantic Compact that are trying to do that, but you really do need almost a national commissioner at this point to oversee all of racing. And federal legislation may eventually make that a reality.
I mentioned Lasix a few minutes ago. That is a drug that is given to horses legally. And in fact, Dr. Rapp, I know that your husband uses Lasix. What is Lasix? What's it designed to do? Isn't that a performance-enhancing drug?
Well, I'd like to clarify that we don't run all of his horses on Lasix. A lot of times they do not run on Lasix for many of their starts in the beginning of their career. However, once you get to the point where somebody thinks they can put your horse on Lasix and improve their performance, then it becomes a risk of losing that horse. So that's the pressure to put a horse possibly on medication it doesn't need. However, what Lasix is, its real name is furosemide. It's a diuretic. But so it makes you lose all of your water weight. And the way it does it, though, it does it in a way where it also leaches a lot of potassium as an electrolyte and calcium in horses, and it dehydrates them. So in addition to the weight loss, they're also getting electrolyte imbalances that come along with the side effect of weight loss. And Lasix has been shown by the effect of loss of weight to improve horses' performance by one length to one and a half lengths per race.
So why is it legal?
It is legal too, as there's research showing that it helps to attenuate the significance of exercise-induced pulmonary hemorrhage, which is known as bleeding, where a horse has small capillaries or sometimes large capillaries in their lung fields that will burst and cause them to bleed, sometimes only a small amount into their trachea that does not affect their performance, and other times massively through their nostrils, and it can even cause death.
Mm. We only have about 30 seconds left, and I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. Dr. Langlois, let me ask you, what has to happen? It seems like just in our conversation, there are several things that has to happen to
number one, protect the health of these horses, but to bring back the fans, and just a whole lot that has to happen.
Yeah, I think the biggest word there would be compromise. I think there has to be compromise on all sides, and right now that's what we're trying to work with. The PVMA is we're actually trying to get together kind of a summit and a stakeholder group to put together to deal with a lot of these issues, but not only deal with them, but okay, if certain things change, what can we as the veterinary community then recommend to the to the horse owners and trainers to make things better?
I want to thank both of you for being with us today. And by the way, I want to say that we reached out to the Pennsylvania State Horse Racing Commission under the Department of Agriculture. Pennsylvania Horse Racing Association both declined our invitation. We didn't return calls or get return calls from the Horse Breeders Association or the Pennsylvania Horsemen Benevolent and Protective Association. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.